It is my absolute pleasure to welcome you all to this panel today. I have introductions to the people on my right, and then I will go sit down and you can listen to them. First up, we have Chris Babbitts, who is an Andrew W. Mellon Engaged Scholar, Initiative Fellow at the University of Texas at Austin. His work analyzes the intersections of religion, medicine, and gender and sexuality. Chris's book monograph, titled To Cure a Sinful Nation, Conversion Therapy in the United States, examines the complex history of sexual reorientation and gender identity therapies from the 1880s to today. Next to Chris, we have Dr. Heather Stone. She's a communication scholar who researches tensions between group and individuals in close-knit societies, including religious communities. She leads the Mormon Homelands Oral History Project, which collects and archives the experiences of women who have lived in predominantly Mormon regions. She's an award-winning teacher who specializes in using technology to improve learning. She has an MBA and is the president of Teton Sports, a manufacturer of camping gear. Her work has been published in the Journal of Communication and Religion, and in 2018, she received the Dissertation of the Year Award from the Religious Communication Association. And then last up, we have Christine Talbot, who is an associate professor and the coordinator of gender studies at the University of Northern Colorado, where she has served for 10 years. She earned a graduate certificate in women's studies and received her doctorate in history from the University of Michigan. Her book, A Foreign Kingdom, Mormons and Polygamy in American Political Culture, 1852 to 1890, published in 2013, examines the national controversy over the Mormon practice of plural marriage. She teaches courses in feminist and queer theories, the history of feminism, intersectionality, and gender studies. I will leave you to it.
Good afternoon, everybody. Jeremy had been worried all day long. He had made an appointment to meet with LDS Social Services about a problem that had plagued him. Jeremy had felt uncomfortable with his same-sex desires for a while. It was now time to confront what the leadership of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints sometimes called the greatest sexual sin, homosexuality. When recounting his experience, Jeremy remembered that it was hard to get himself to LDS Social Services. He was nervous about attending his first group counseling session. He couldn't believe that there were going to be other men just like him, all with the same problem. Jeremy's anxiety caused him to have diarrhea, which lasted for much of the workday. He wasn't going to let nerves get the best of him, though. Not this time. He knew that getting his same-sex desires under control was something that he had to do. Eventually, I gathered my courage and showed my face to LDS Social Services to participate in my first group therapy meeting, Jeremy remembered. Jeremy saw this as the first step in escaping personal and spiritual isolation and in being integrated in Mormonism's familial, sexual, and gendered ethos. In the 1980s and 1990s, LDS Social Services treated thousands of men and women with same-sex desires. Latter-day Saints who pursued therapy did so for a variety of reasons. Most notably, they felt isolated from LDS teachings on the issue of homosexuality. In the 1960s and 1970s, untold numbers of Mormons underwent painful electroshock therapy to create an aversive response to having same-sex attractions. By the early 1990s, LDS Social Services abandoned electroshock treatments for a gendered-based treatment known as reparative therapy. In doing so, therapeutic and counseling efforts to reduce and/or eliminate same-sex desires focused less on homosexual feelings, attractions, and fantasies. Instead, reparative therapy stressed the importance of performing traditional gender roles. This focus on gendered belonging was fostered in individual and group counseling sessions with LDS mental health specialists. Psychologists like A.D. Byrne, the assistant commissioner of LDS Social Services and a clinical faculty member of the Department of Psychology at Brigham Young University in the early 1990s, theorized that by treating patients' deficient gender identity, he could foster heterosexual development. Reparative therapy was controversial, to say the least, especially in the face of a growing gay rights movement. In order to push back against the political gains of gay activists, though, Mormon reparative therapists like Byrd built bridges with evangelical, Catholic, and Orthodox Jewish therapists, effectively creating a conservative ecumenism that united multiple faith traditions in America's culture wars. In these ways, gender reparative therapy provided the means for two integrative processes. The first of these processes allowed for LDS men and women with same-sex desires to be incorporated into the church, whereas the second helped politically and socially conservative Mormons be an accepted and indeed an integral part of the Family Values political coalition. Inspiration for Mormon-based reparative therapy came from an unlikely source. Dr. Elizabeth Moberly, a British pastoral counselor whose homosexuality, a new Christian ethic, introduced the theoretical underpinnings for these gender-based interventions to combat same-sex desires. Moberly's approach for treating gay men and lesbians focused on the emotional needs that children had with their same-sex parent. She stressed, for instance, how fathers served as an important love source for their sons. Moberly contended that if homosocial bonding failed to occur between fathers and sons, this caused a defect in the child's relational capacity. Sons would never learn what it meant to be a man, and in turn, this defect would continue to spread. Moberly argued that these young men with relational problems had trouble bonding with other males. This lack of love and support, which created a gender identity deficit, ultimately turned sexual. Moberly insisted that if this desire for male affection was not addressed, it turned into the reparative urge of the homosexual impulse. In sum, Moberly thought that same-sex sexual desires could be traced to parental failures, the shortcomings of fathers for sons, the inadequacy of mothers for daughters. The solution, however, was to create a strong sense of gendered belonging. In a 1993 interview, Berg, a Latter-day Saint convert, expanded on Moberly's therapeutic insights. He claimed that in over 20 years of helping men with same-sex desires, a clear majority come to view their homosexual attractions as a need to be affirmed in their own masculinity by other significant men. Berg noted that once patients became, quote, solid in their own masculinity, therapy was often easier to handle and transitions in their lives are easier to make. He emphasized how it was important to separate the sexual from the emotional needs of patients. Bird said that it was essential to not only address the defensive detachment that patients felt from their fathers, but to also develop intimate, non-sexual, fulfilling relationships with other men. The therapist served as the first figure to whom the patient could form these strong homosocial bonds. Despite having same-sex desires themselves, the group in the men in group counseling sessions could also be key figures in a patient's quest for intimate, though non-sexual, relationships. Joining a sports league also provided Bird's patients an opportunity to form these strong homosexual bonds. Bird and other reparative therapists observed that mastery on the baseball diamond or on the hockey rink gave patients the sense of masculine identity that they believed had been missing from their lives. In the early 1990s, Bird's treatment methods involved a tripartite approach that focused on helping men leave what Bird called the homosexual lifestyle. Bird's early sessions focused on behavioral control as a prerequisite to behavioral change. These counseling sessions could focus on performing traditional gender, both in the office, at home, or even in the general public. Bird's intermediate sessions, on the other hand, emphasized a cognitive interruption of the obsessive-compulsive process. These counseling sessions would likely work on decreasing the frequency of same-sex fantasies. The third phase of Bird's counseling program focused on effective relating in a group setting. These later sessions included the hallmarks of reparative therapy. According to Bird, this was where the following happened: development of a non-erotic support system with heterosexual men, assertiveness with self and others, defensive detachment and masculinity issues, frustration with change, forgiveness, and also realistic expectations from self and others, feelings of discrimination and intimacy issues. Obviously working with a lot there. Bird's tripartite approach revealed the intense commitment that patients needed if they hoped to undergo reorientation therapy. Throughout his career, Bird also recognized the important role that religion and spiritual transformation had in the process of gendered and sexual conversion. He said, for example, that there is a strong spiritual part of the healing process, and he highlighted how, quote, these men have some very powerful spiritual experiences as they become affirmed in who they are. LDS leadership created the conditions for the spiritual transformation by changing how they talked about homosexuality. As Alan Michael Williams observed in Mormon and Queer at the Crossroads, there was an emphasis that only homosexual acts were sinful. In other words, same-sex feelings, attractions, and fantasies were not sinful in and of themselves. This newfound position provided space for Mormons with same-sex desires to seek the help of numerous Latter-day Saint officials. In 1991, the first presidency stated that homosexual individuals and their families should seek counsel from their bishop, branch president, stake, or district president. In the same statement, the first presidency also encouraged church leaders and members to reach out with love and understanding to those struggling with same-sex desires. Byrd, for his part, stressed how he had, quote, never worked successfully with an LDS man who has homosexual struggles without a close collaborative relationship with a bishop or stake president. He elaborated that for LDS men, there are many spiritual issues, and these priesthood leaders have had a significant impact on the healing process. Though other reparative therapists work closely with religious leaders, for example, Dr. Nicolosi, the Catholic founder of the Thomas Aquinas Psychological Clinic in Encino, California, worked with the Los Angeles Archdiocese, the level of cooperation between Mormon health mental health professionals and LDS bishops and stake presidents wasn't as common in other religion and faith traditions. LDS beliefs on gender and sexuality created the social and cultural pressures for Mormon men and women to pursue reparative therapy. The Latter-day Saint cosmology of eternal gender, for instance, provided a religious basis for gender-based therapeutic efforts to combat same-sex desires. In Same Gender Attraction, a 1995 article in the Ensign, Elder Davlin H. Oakes asserted that, quote, when or what we call gender was an essential characteristic of our existence prior to our birth. Eternal gender insists that humans are innately male and female, both in the earthly and the heavenly worlds. Mormon cosmology highlights the importance of males and females to enter into an earthly marriage as well. These opposite gender marriages in turn form the sexual and reproductive basis of the normative or traditional family. And procreation in the earthly realm becomes doubly important because of this heavenly potential. Mormon cosmology maintains the potential for believers to become gods and goddesses like Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. Alan Michael Williams stated that the potential to become divine parents of spiritual children who will go through the formative experience human beings are currently undergoing serves as one of the foundations of the movement towards divine parenthood. These pressures to perform traditional gender roles and start a family have the ability to weigh deeply on LDS men and women as they navigate the earthly realm. These aspects of Mormon cosmology fueled the growth of reparative therapy in LDS circles, particularly in the wake of second wave feminism, gay rights, and the AIDS epidemic. Such concerns affected married and unmarried Mormons with homosexual attractions. Caleb, for instance, told interviewers that he, quote, knew that a second coming of Christ was just around the corner and that my wife and family would be able or would be given to somebody else if he didn't control his same-sex desires. Joseph, on the other hand, was consumed over fears that he'd never marry. When he telephoned LDS Social Services, the counselor asked Joseph what his plans were. He responded that he hoped to get married and have a family. Joseph wanted to know the prospects for earthly and heavenly marriage. The counselor thought that Joseph could tackle his same-sex desires. Hearing these words from the counselor was like a godsend. He really gave me hope, Joseph recounted. I remember getting off the phone, and I had never been so excited in my life. He made me feel like it was something I could deal with. He gave me hope that I might not turn out to be a disaster case. That was the first good thing I had ever heard about it. The possibility of having a family gave Joseph a glimmer of hope that reparative therapy could work for him. It also provided an opportunity to become fully integrated into Mormon culture and cosmology. Mormon adoption and refinement of reparative therapy helped another process of political and cultural integration in the last third of the 20th century. In the late 1970s, the Family Values Political Coalition began its ascendancy to power. Traditional historical narratives highlight the political issues that drew together an eclectic religious coalition opposed to such things as second wave feminism, gay rights, and bans on public school prayer. And we gather together, the religious right and the problems of interfaith politics, however, Neil J. Young argued that theology, not politics, has united conservative Mormons, evangelicals, and Catholics from the late 1970s to today. Elsewhere, I've argued that the political theology of the religious right was driven by a conservative understanding of gender, sexuality, and family. Reparative therapy was one of the clearest examples where conservative ecumenism formed around theological understandings of the normative family and traditional gender roles. More specifically, Dean Bird could find inspiration in Joseph Nicolosi's Reparative Therapy of Male Homosexuality, published in 1991, because Mormonism's eternal gender shared political and theological commonalities with Catholic natural law. Indeed, Nicolosi and Bird formed a close working relationship as members of the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality and as co-authors of numerous academic articles together. Importantly, the annual meeting of the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality, it's better known as NARTH, continues to bring together conservative evangelicals, Mormons, and Catholics who share a deep commitment to sexual orientation change efforts and gender identity therapies. Until the past several years, the conservative ecumenism of the Family Values Coalition had stood firmly behind the ethics and efficacy of reparative therapy. Religious declarations about the sanctity of the family and so-called natural gender roles read similarly, particularly as the gay rights movement began making headway in the fight for marriage equality. These statements insisted that the best hope for combating same-sex desires was a mix of gender-based therapy and intense religious devotion. Therapy, in turn, would make the need for gay marriage non-existent. Over the past 5 years, however, the LDS Church has backed away from its past support of what's popularly and sometimes derisively known as conversion therapy. Earlier this year, LDS leadership issued a formal statement stating that it would not oppose a legislative effort to ban conversion therapy on minors. Although this conversion therapy ban wasn't approved by the Utah State Legislature, the church's lack of enthusiasm for reparative therapy was a welcome sign for LGBTQ Mormons. In the past, reparative therapy had provided hope for men and women who had internalized LDS teachings on gender and sexuality. Now, LGBTQ Latter-day Saints, who had no desire to change, have their own hope for the future. They can, possibly for the first time in their lives, feel like the church could, in due time, accept them for who they are.
This presentation reports on one theme I found in a larger oral history project that I completed last year for my dissertation. First, a thank you to the oral history narrators. Sharing your life story is vulnerable and brave, and I've done my best to honor and respect them. If I've made errors, I apologize. Let me give a few quick facts about the project, and then I'll jump right to the narrator's experiences in relation to isolation. Who were the narrators? 55 adult women, so a very large group of participants for an oral history project. They moved into Mormon homelands as teenagers between 1975 and 2000. So they were ages 12 to 19 during that time period. Mormon homelands in this project, and we don't have time to go in depth into the explanation, but it's essentially the regions of North America where Mormons settled from 1847 to 1910. The women I interviewed are now living in 4 countries and 16 US states, and a lot of them still live in Mormon homelands. They had to be members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as young women, but they did not have to be members of the church as adults. So 78% are members now, 15% say they are not members, and 7% say that it is somewhere in between for them. And I would like to note that I use the term Mormon. I know in religious studies we like to use the terminology of the religious group under study, but Mormon reflected the historical time period, and it reflected the study period as well. So I won't usually be saying the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but it's not a lack of respect for the church's naming conventions. The selection process. So this was history, not social science. So don't be wowed by the 55 participants and think that it's a statistically valid sample. It's an oral history participation list. The call was distributed mostly electronically via email and social media, and I distributed it in anywhere that I thought people would have a connection to Mormon homelands. So geography-based groups, Mormon-centric groups, women's groups, and anti- or nuanced Mormon groups and lists. I received 370 applicants in 10 days. Then I panicked and shut off the call, because that was plenty. I narrowed it to those who moved in secondary school, not college, which took out most of the 19-year-olds. And then I spoke to everyone who would schedule with me. Yay for history. An advisor once told me historians read everything. Try that in oral history. The interviews were long-form oral history interviews, 97 and a half audio hours when we were finished here, 2,833 transcribed pages. The archive, 54 women gave permission for their stories to be archived and available to researchers and the public. That donation is in process. I'm sorry that it's not done yet. The Eileen H. Clyde 20th Century Women's Legacy Archive at the University of Utah has asked for those stories, and we're in the process of making that donation. It's full transcriptions and audio for those 55 stories, and hopefully it will be available very soon. So let's talk about the experiences, at least some of them. You know, this no paper like this could ever represent the full perspectives of 55 women, and that's something to remember here. This is a case study. Many of these women came for safety to Mormon homelands. So some narrators came as teenagers because they needed protection or their parents sought protection for them. They wanted to escape a threatening world and be sheltered by a community of believers. Often they did find the safety they were seeking. Many of them told how moving to Mormon homelands improved their lives, made them happy, helped protect them spiritually or physically from harmful situations. In 1985, Charlotte's parents hauled the family of nine from a predominantly non-Mormon community to Springville, Utah, a predominantly Mormon community, without a job lined up in order to, quote, save her. Her 13-year-old friends were all sexually active, and Charlotte says she doesn't know how long it could have gone on with her abstaining because she was very interested in being accepted. The move gave Charlotte a peer group who shared her beliefs and removed her from immediate danger. Sophia's parents, worried about losing their children to negative peer influences while living in Washington State, so they relocated to Sunset, Utah in 1996 in order to be in a Mormon culture, also without employment arranged. Sophia says, quote, they felt like, let's go to Zion. Let's go where there are lots of members, where we can have lots of support, where we'd be going to school with a lot of other members of the church. Sophia was relieved to be submerged in the Utah culture, her words, and to be surrounded by LDS friends and to go to school where there was release time available and that sort of thing. She believes she had many more opportunities to strengthen her belief in God and Mormonism and grow as a person than she would have had in Washington. Isolation was seen as the way to accomplish this safety. So parents, and in some cases young women themselves, were hoping to reduce proximity to danger by coming to Mormon homelands. Young women did seem to make more righteous and safe choices in communities that supported and even pressured them to do so. Parents often take inconvenient and expensive measures to protect their children. So Mormon parents' desire to protect their children could be understood as a relatively ordinary reaction. However, one thing that may have made this move more extreme for the young women was the degree of isolation they encountered in Mormon homelands. Many narrators never or rarely encountered people, concepts, and practices outside of Mormonism once they moved to homelands. Not every person living in the homeland communities narrators lived was Mormon, but young women rarely interacted with people not of the faith. Hard to imagine in today's network world. Patty moved from Virginia to Orem when she was 16. She says everybody was LDS. I mean, at Orem High School circa 1992, you could count the non-members on one hand. Another young woman, Stella, who moved from Southern California to Bountiful, Utah in 1981, said the whole social makeup, the whole social cliques, networks, everything was based on what ward do you live in? It was always about the church. When a single organization or society influences nearly all aspects of a person's life, scholars call that organization or society totalistic. A totalistic society connects spheres usually kept distinct, such as home, work, and school, thereby preventing a person from varying her identity in each sphere, thus reducing her agency. Scholar Sarah Tracy observed that employees on a cruise ship are required to smile at guests or wear certain clothing, even when they're not on shift. Because the ship serves as both residence and employer, staff members cannot control their off-duty lives the way they could were they able to leave work each day and return to private homes. In any group, some compromise of individuality is necessary because doing things other people's way is a normal cost of sustaining relationships, being part of a group, and working together. Ordinarily, the constraints a group imposes on an individual are not unduly burdensome because group membership is voluntary and no single affiliation affects all facets of life. So compliance with the collective standards is temporary and limited. However, membership in a group or society can become onerous to agency if one's complete life is enacted within that environment. Many narrators who participated in this study said they experienced this kind of totalizing isolation. They described two ways isolation was maintained: fear of the world and surveillance by other Mormons. Church discourse of the period encouraged a fear of the world. One Young Woman lesson equated philosophies and attitudes of the world with deceptions of Satan. Another lesson had as its objective, each young woman will prepare herself to withstand worldly pressures. The teacher was supposed to decorate a piece of foam rubber to look like a beautiful cake and then give it to the young women. When they tasted it, they would realize how Satan makes, quote, philosophies and attitudes of the world look appealing, and how young women must defend themselves against worldliness. Young women were told not to dress worldly and avoid dating non-Mormons because the dangers of sexual promiscuity were higher when associating with young men who were in the world, not in the faith. The warning against worldliness was church-wide during this time, although when combined with homeland isolation, the message may have been applied more totalistically in Mormon homelands than elsewhere. In homeland societies, narrators felt Mormons were perceived as good and everyone else was perceived as bad. For narrators who had lived in that outside world and personally known non-Mormons before coming to the homelands, this oversimplification felt disrespectful and inaccurate. Unlike homeland peers who had never lived in Mormon minority communities, narrators had interacted with many people who were in the world. Some of those not Mormons were admirable, some less so. Further, narrators did not believe all Mormons were themselves admirable. Young women thought homelanders were naive for believing in stereotypes. Group surveillance. Isolation encourages surveillance. When a society believes the outside world is dangerous, that society must be continually watchful. Narrators found most people they interacted with in homeland society monitored and assessed their behavior, which narrators found demeaning and disempowering. Peers, parents of peers, teachers, young women leaders, other adults in the ward, and ward leaders all seemed to feel a responsibility to critique a young woman's adherence to Mormon standards. Narrators were surprised this kind of distributed correction was socially acceptable in Mormon homelands. Outside of homelands, such behavior would have been labeled gossip. Homeland surveillance seemed reminiscent of the echelon authority sociologist Irving Goffman observed in totalistic societies, where society members are subject to a supervisor group rather than accountable to a single individual, such as God. Echelon authority spawns chronic anxiety in those being watched and draws all members of society into surveillance. In homeland societies these women lived in, surveillance seems to have overemphasized outward behavior, perhaps because inner conversion cannot be as easily surveilled. Sophia says homeland societies are too focused on how a person looks when being a Mormon rather than how a person believes when being a Mormon. Kendra says that the surveillance made it seem like Mormonism was not about God. She says it was more about following the rules and checking up on people to make sure that they've been to church last week and things like that. Joanna says constant critique by other members drained away her, quote, love and devotion for the church, and she started going more for other people and for her parents rather than for herself for the first time in her life. So the implications of isolation. Totalism scholars have demonstrated that isolationist strategies of social control require an enemy. That enemy must be fearsome enough to scare community members into respecting the outer walls, be those walls virtual or physical. Isolation is most easily maintained when members of the society are perpetually afraid, so they willingly become engaged in creating and maintaining the division between us and them. That way, responsibility for enforcing rules of entrance and exit becomes shared among the whole society rather than resting only with designated authorities. Nearly all societies with rigid borders have in common a fear of the other. And in Mormon homelands, societies from 1975 through 2000, many narrators felt that other was non-Mormonism. Homelanders, in attempts to isolate and protect young women, sometimes acted as if those of the Mormon faith were not individuals, but instead were a single monolithic entity called bad influence. This was a cognitive and discursive dehumanization. Narrators felt non-Mormons were not given consideration as actual living beings with varied characteristics. According to Karen Stoltz, now scholar, dehumanization sets up a good versus bad claim that justifies society's exclusion or mistreatment of people or groups by depicting them as not equal to mainstream society and therefore not deserving of humane regard. Many narrators thought homelanders seemed to forget gospel teachings that everyone is a child of God with unique attributes and talents. The desire for safety overshadowed the belief in charity. A second implication of isolation is that young women were depicted as helpless. Isolation needs an enemy, but it also needs a victim. Some totalistic societies justify social control by claiming a segment of the population will be irreparably harmed without community protection. Benevolent societies, in particular, can become oppressive when their rhetoric shifts from empowerment to safety. When keeping beneficiaries safe becomes a higher priority than helping those beneficiaries improve themselves, a society starts to reduce individual liberties in increasingly extreme ways. In Mormon homeland societies from 1975 through 2000, some narrators described how leaders and parents frequently treated young women as helpless victims who would not be safe unless isolated. Two messages related to this were particularly demeaning and disempowering to narrators. First, proximity inevitably leads to sin, and second, sinning permanently destroys a young woman. If proximity inevitably leads to sin, then a young woman is continually at risk. The implication is that she has no means within herself to resist sin. It is not in her nature to do so. This helplessness justifies isolation. Narrators felt that homeland Mormon societies distrusted them and doubted their abilities to make good choices when people around them were not doing so. This was confusing and offensive to the young women. Outside of homeland communities, leaders and parents had expected narrators to be righteous when they attended school all day in proximity to people outside the faith. They had been expected to say no when pressured to make sinful choices. Yet in homeland communities, young women felt that leaders intentionally kept rules strict because they believed young women would otherwise be unable to resist temptation. Narrators had been exposed to a variety of perspectives before moving to homelands and had begun to develop their own moral codes. So it was a shock to be told in homeland societies that they were not strong enough, smart enough, or old enough to resist the temptations of the world. Homeland societies also seemed to suggest that if a young woman sinned, she would be destroyed forever, spiritually and socially. Conceptualizing sin as permanent, and by association the sinner as permanently flawed, further justifies isolation as a form of social control because the stakes of failure to protect are so high. Charlotte, Tori, and other narrators remember hearing a young women lesson that compared a young woman who has had sex before marriage with a piece of chewed up gum no one would ever want. Tori, who moved from Colorado to Clearfield, Utah in 1993, had been sexually active with her boyfriend prior to the gum and abstinence lesson. She was fairly certain her young women leaders were not aware of her sexual activities when they taught her that she should be discarded like a piece of gum. As adolescents, some narrators sought to reconcile the demeaning messages that the effects of sin are permanent with their understandings of church theology. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints teaches that Jesus Christ voluntarily gave up his life as penance for everyone's sins. Since Jesus Christ has paid the price for moral wickedness and thereby satisfied justice, once a person stops sinning and forsakes the unrighteous behavior, she can be fully restored to purity without having to endure eternal damnation. This central doctrine of Mormonism is called the Atonement of Jesus Christ. Narrators said homelanders spoke generically of the atonement and forgiveness, but when it came to believing a specific person had changed, homelanders seemed less willing to accept the possibility of true restoration. Telling women and youth they need protection is not an unusual message for a society to send, and it is normal for parents to want to shield children. However, totalism occurs when a desire to protect becomes colonizing, and some segment of the population is seen as inferior beings in need of rescue by those who are morally superior. An isolation that is nearly total fosters dependence and discourages young women from making decisions about their own lives. So the adult responses. Oral history connects past and present, so you can hear the youthful responses and the adult responses. Now that narrators are adults, many have difficulty accepting the binary of practicing Mormons being righteous and everyone else being dangerous that they encountered in Mormon homelands. They resist what they call Mormon self-righteousness. Whenever they encounter it, they refuse to isolate their own children, and they stand up for religious diversity. Narrators invent pejoratives such as utards and sidozes, which is stalwart young daughters of Zion, to describe self-righteous homeland Mormons. Karen has declared one area of the Arkansas community where she lives to be Little Utah, because women there all seem to believe that they are living Mormonism better than others. Lynn's daughters encounter a chapter of the Utah Mormons Club whenever they wear bikinis and are chastised by cousins. Lynn has tried to teach her daughters the difference between the gospel and the club. She says, in Arizona, we had the gospel, not the club. The club are the ones who say, I don't know you, but I'm going to judge you by this picture of you in a backless dress. She says this club mentality is the reason people leave the church. Ruth, who lives in Ohio with her husband and children, sums it up by saying, you can be a Utah Mormon without being from Utah. Utah Mormon just means you're a bad Mormon. Utah Mormon seems to be a rhetorical container that narrators have invented to store the resentment, frustration, and anger they feel when church members living anywhere do not act with the charity they believe a devotion to Christ should ensure. Narrators have also refused to isolate their own children. They're earnest in protecting them, but their approach is different in that they safeguard via what one narrator called inoculation. In medicine, isolation involves keeping a contagion apart from the subject, while inoculation involves controlled exposure rather than a comprehensive ban. When a person is inoculated, she accepts a small dose of negative substance into her body so the body will recognize and be resistant to that substance if it recurs in larger doses. For narrators, spiritual inoculation meant educating children about a wide variety of beliefs and behaviors in hopes of developing their internal resilience when it comes to making righteous choices. Narrators believe inoculation is a more empowering approach than isolation because it focuses on building internal strength rather than removing proximity. Claudia came to Mormon homelands in 1992 at the age of 15 from Japan. She and her family are active LDS all the way. She hopes, her words, not mine, she hopes, if I expose my kids to ideas and opinions while they're in the home, when they're in an environment where I can talk to them and I can help them work through it, then they will go out in the world more prepared because they've already come across these issues. She used to go to parties as a youth where people were drinking, and she decided for herself not to drink. She says, it was never an issue for me from then on out because it was my personal choice. If you were never confronted with that, then you've never made that choice for yourself. I want them to, before they leave, know where they stand and to know somewhat really how they feel about things, and that's hard to do if you've never been exposed to anything. Narrators want to teach their own children and other young women to be good no matter what others do rather than to merely avoid temptation. Narrators believe their children and people in general will make healthy spiritual choices if given freedom to choose for themselves. They hope to embed their children in mainstream society carefully and intentionally with a parental and church lifeline to help if need be. They do not believe proximity to sin invariably leads to sin. The world is no longer seen as an evil place that must be avoided. The battle for souls has moved from an external site, such as a party or the backseat of a car, to an internal site, the heart and mind. Narrators say an inoculation approach respects the humanity of all parties. Mormons with unusual practices and people of different faiths are not considered potential contaminants. Young women are not viewed as helpless. Agency is honored, and young women have a chance to develop internal resources such as conscience and a belief in God that will help them be safe and well in any setting, not just when insulated by other Mormons. An inoculation strategy also acknowledges that sin will not forever destroy a person. And a final adult response. That we'll talk about today. Many narrators now seek the company of non-Mormons as adults. Brynhilda is an LDS woman, they chose their own pseudonyms, who moved in 1998 from South Dakota to Rexburg, Idaho, to attend church-owned Brigham Young University, then Ricks College. She does not want her daughters to attend a church college since they are being raised in Utah. She says, I think that if you spend your entire life in Utah, you need to see what the real world is like. I think to be functional as an adult, you need to be able to realize that not everybody thinks the same thing as you, and that's okay and doesn't make them evil. Abigail and her husband bought a house in a diverse area of Salt Lake City, Utah, hoping their offspring could avoid the homogenized experience Abigail had as a homeland teenager. She explains their housing decision by saying, I didn't necessarily want to be surrounded by people who are all exactly like me. What Abigail said she missed most when she came from Washington State to Tooele, Utah as a teenager was people who don't all think exactly the same. She says homeland Mormons have a hive mind kind of mentality. Adult narrators are mindful about messages they may be sending to children and others regarding non-Mormons' diversity and kindness. Narrators seem to resent the trade-off of charity for safety they unwittingly accepted as youthful homeland dwellers. And as adults, they engage consciously with how to embrace diversity and still preserve safety. They want to be part of the world outside of Mormonism while receiving protection from the perils of that world should it become necessary. Narrators want to achieve safety and promote religious diversity without being uncharitable. So in conclusion, the women I spoke with had both positive and negative experiences in Mormon homelands. The isolation they found made them safer, protected them from harm, and in many cases helped them find peace and joy. It also constrained their agency and required them to accept paradigms that people different from them were evil and that they themselves were helpless. This research explores how the self can be preserved by both isolation and integration. It examines what can happen when barriers are erected to protect the individual from society, and considers ways agency, power, and compassion might be compromised when the desire to protect becomes extreme. The tension between integration and isolation is not only a Mormon story or a Mormon homeland story. It takes place anytime people make a commitment to work, live, or play together. I hope this research will help us all become more successful at identifying imbalance between group and individual in our lives. Scholars have shown that totalizing control is often well-intentioned. It is sometimes believed necessary to protect individuals and is thought by many to be a reliable way to ensure people will work together when failure to do so might harm bodies or souls. Totalism of adolescents and children is often rationalized as fulfilling normal adult responsibilities. Understanding the ways these young women were isolated in Mormon homelands from 1975 to 2000 may make it easier for us to identify when individuality is being suppressed in other contexts. Every group is totalizing to some degree, and every person is somewhat controlled by her group memberships. Self-awareness seems to be the best defense. I invite you to peruse the oral history archive created for this project, the moment it's available, to read narrator stories about Mormon homelands, and to use this information to consider these questions for yourself.
Welcome, and thank you for coming, and thank you to my esteemed co-panelists for hanging out with me for a couple of hours today. I am from Colorado, and there seems to be something in the air here that is making me much more allergic, and it's all right here, so I apologize in advance for the excessive blinking. you're all just going to have to tolerate it. So the title of my presentation today is called Out-Family-ing the Mormons, Gender and Family in ERA Politics Among the Mormons, and again, I'm also using the term in a somewhat historical way. It was very, very common parlance in the 1970s and 80s in the community to use the term. In December 1976, the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or LDS, or Mormon Church, issued their first formal statement in opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment, or the ERA, which is the thing that was intended to give women constitutional equality. At the time, Sonia Ann Harris Johnson considered herself, quote, mildly pro-ERA, but mostly apolitical. Although she had a doctoral degree in education and taught occasional college classes as an exploited and underpaid adjunct, Johnson conceived of her primary role as a traditional Mormon housewife and mother of four children. Curious about the church's opposition to the amendment, Johnson attended a meeting at her local Virginia church house where local male church leaders had promised to explain the church's position against the ERA. Reflecting on this event, Johnson reported that the leader of the meeting had announced that he knew nothing about the proposed amendment, so had stopped at the 7-Eleven on the way to the meeting and purchased a copy of Pageant magazine, which Johnson rather generously called a cheap Reader's Digest. He had quickly read the magazine during the opening song and found himself sufficiently informed to tell the women of the congregation why they should oppose the ERA. Johnson credits this event with her feminist epiphany, and so began her 3-year-plus confrontation with the LDS Church and her lifelong career as a women's liberation thinker and activist. Advocate rather than activist, that's a whole thing. In winter 1978, Johnson co-founded Mormons for ERA, M-E-R-A, with three other women in direct challenge to the anti-ERA activism church leaders had advocated from every LDS pulpit in the nation just months before. Within 18 months, Johnson was excommunicated from the faith in which five generations of her family had made their lives. Johnson's activism and subsequent excommunication, alongside her eloquence, humor, and charm, made her a national political and media sensation. In the months surrounding her excommunication, discussion of what she called the family feud between Johnson and her supporters and the LDS Church flooded mainstream and feminist presses. Johnson's activism and Johnson was in high demand as a public speaker, giving dozens and perhaps hundreds, I haven't really counted, of speeches over those months and the next few years. So while the church and second wave feminism had never been particularly friendly, because of Sonia Johnson, the conflicts between them came to a head in a very public and visible way. In her brief period as the public face of LDS feminism, Johnson publicly articulated some of the profound spiritual and political anguish many LDS women experienced under church patriarchy, and especially in the wake of the church's vigorous opposition to the ERA. So today I want to focus on how the central players in this family feud deployed both their gendered identities and the rhetoric of gender and family to their political ends. I'll argue that debates between Johnson and her supporters and church leaders were about more than the ERA. They were also, first, contests over identity and authority. Who had the qualifications to speak for and about LDS women's wants and needs, pains and joys? The debates among Mormons that attracted national attention were a microcosm for national debates about gender, family, and feminism in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And I'll argue, second, that in this case, the discussion was theologically and culturally inflected with Mormonism in ways that shaped the role of gender and family in constituting the relationship between Mormonism and feminism for decades to come. The LDS Church's position opposing the ERA developed over time, but because we're short on time, I'm going to sort of sum it up. And I'm also going to focus on the pieces that are more directly about gender and family, keeping in mind that the church also produced a set of legal arguments about the relationship between church and state, states' rights and limited government, and the legal processes they dreaded would ensue should the ERA pass. The First Presidency released four official statements of their position, beginning each with a brief rehearsal of the church's 19th century history of support for women's suffrage and women's rights. They also, each time, declared that they do not intervene in political affairs, but that they were convinced that the ERA was, quote, a moral rather than a political issue, close quote, because it threatened divinely ordained gender and family arrangements. Church leaders feared that the ERA would, quote, stifle many God-given feminine instincts, close quote, although they were fairly unclear about what these were. I can presume that they were those instincts sort of related to bearing and raising children. But they also thought that the ERA would, quote, encourage those who promoted a unisex society, close quote, producing such horrors as gender-integrated changing rooms, locker rooms, restrooms, and military housing. They also argued that the amendment would, quote, invite legal action on every conceivable point of conflict between men and women. So if you have a fight with your husband, the logical solution is that you will sue him. magnifying tensions in marital relationships, sorry. Moreover, passage could facilitate such immoral behavior as homosexuality, abortion, and, quote, a possible train of unnamed unnatural consequences. Before long, their reasoning suggested that the ERA could challenge, quote, every morally accepted behavior pattern in America. Church leaders believed that taken together, these aspects of the ERA, quote, would demean women rather than ennoble them, close quote. So the positions that the LDS Church took against the ERA were not unusual among conservatives, particularly conservative Christians, but for the LDS faithful, they took on an unusual theological valence. In a book written for LDS Women Confused by the Multivalent Voices of the 1970, his terms not mine, Oscar W. McConkie reminded readers that gender was an eternal characteristic of the self. Feminine characteristics such as long-suffering, unselfishness, and the ability to sense a proper moment to teach a child, and talent for belief, were attached to female bodies by God. That which threatened these natural feminine characteristics, then, was an assault on God's word and God's divinely ordained gender and family order. Gender, for Latter-day Saints, was eternal and different but equal. Informed by these claims and a theology that supported them, and under the direction of the church leaders headquartered in Utah, local congregations mobilized armies of women into lobbying groups with names like the Virginia LDS Citizens Coalition, Women for Integrity in the Nation, and Pro-Family Unity. Women around the country reported that the ERA was condemned from the pulpit, and sometimes members were instructed to return home from church with plans to call their congressional representatives to vote against the ERA. In 1978, Johnson, a Temple-recommend-holding Mormon housewife, made her first public appearance in support of the ERA before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Property Rights in August of that year. She, a well-educated but a housewife, testified alongside a Catholic priest, a rabbi, and a United Presbyterian minister in support of the ERA. Her five-minute speech quoted 19th-century LDS women equal rights activists who, with the full support of church leadership, advocated for women's suffrage and women's rights. Surely, she claimed, these women would support the ERA. In deploying church history in this fashion, Johnson not only echoed the structure of official church statements, she also spoke, I think, a kind of insider code to her LDS listeners, and quite possibly to LDS Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, a fairly powerful member of the committee. Mormonism is a faith peculiarly invested in its history. Belief in Mormonism is constituted in part by belief in truth claims about 19th century historical events. Joseph Smith really saw God and Jesus in the woods near Palmyra, New York, really received the Book of Mormon on golden plates from an angel of God, and really received the official priesthood from resurrected New Testament apostles. In this context, Johnson's deployment of church history bespeaks a deployment of Mormonism's fundamental identity as a faith. As Richard Bushman, one of the faith's most well-respected believing professional historians, claims, Mormonism is history, not philosophy. In the question and answer period that followed, Johnson and Hatch had a fiery exchange, apparently rebroadcast by news outlets around the country, although I've not been able to find it. If anyone has it or knows where it is, hook me up. Hatch declared, "I think that you would have to admit that in the Mormon church, almost 100% of the women are against the Equal Rights Amendment, right?" The battle was on. A previously sleepy hearing woke up, and press representatives started paying attention. Johnson responded in shock, "Oh my goodness," and paused for the applause to die, and then stated, "I don't have to admit that. It's simply not true." Hatch responded with a vituperative declaration about the meaning of Mormon womanhood that he cast in very personal terms. He said, "I think implicit in your remarks is that Mormon women are not as smart as you. You are saying that if they were not following church leaders and thinking for themselves, they would agree with you. This is not my conception of Mormon womanhood. I've met lots of brilliant Mormon women. My wife is one of them." Johnson and others later reported that at this point, Hatch had come so unglued that his aides had to try to restrain him. "It was beautiful," she said. So this event matters because it was Johnson's introduction to the power of national media coverage that she would use effectively throughout her activism to, in some instances, discredit the church's anti-ERA position. By Johnson's account, after the hearing, reporters swarmed around her asking for an interview, and she returned their affections generously. It also matters because Hatch's vituperative attack on a common housewife and Johnson's composed and witty responses had frankly made the church look bad. Johnson retold the story over and over at pro-ERA rallies, meetings, demonstrations, continuing to make the church look bad. Most importantly, Johnson's confrontation with Hatch suggests a critical element of the debate between Johnson and her supporters and church leaders. Ultimately, this confrontation, like the broader debate it inaugurated, was about much more than the ERA. It was an identity-based contest over the meaning of Mormon womanhood. Johnson, a fifth-generation true-believing housewife, and Hatch, an LDS priesthood holder, each claiming to be an authority on the subject, Hatch fairly oblivious to the irony. Johnson's use of LDS history may have also been part of what so irked Hatch about her presentation. She, a woman and a housewife, framed LDS church history in support of the ERA, contesting the vision of Mormonism's anti-ERA sentiments that belonged to him, a priesthood holder. More broadly, the way this event framed the Mormon family feud over the ERA as a question of identity and authority set the stage for years to come. Like Hatch, church leaders claimed a monopoly on knowledge about what was good for LDS women. Johnson claimed the same authority by deploying her identity as a fifth-generation Mormon housewife, mother, insider, and true believer. While these questions of authority remained a constant undercurrent in these debates, they resurfaced more powerfully, perhaps, in the controversy over Johnson's appearance on The Donahue Show. And it's not totally clear to me whether this was in December of 79 or January of 1980. I don't know. Without going into too much detail, Donahue erroneously claimed during Johnson's appearance that the church had refused to send a spokesperson. In fact, First Presidency-endorsed spokeswoman Beverly Campbell had been on her way to the airport to fly to the show when she learned that Johnson had refused to appear with her. In an interview with Utah Holiday magazine, Johnson claimed that she had told Donahue representatives she would appear with any church leader instrumental in policy decisions, but not with Campbell. She said, quote, "To make it appear that this was some local squabble, a fight between two women in Virginia, would trivialize it," close quote. Johnson claimed that her enemies were church policymakers, not the women of the church who had no voice in creating these policies, and she continued to refuse to debate LDS women about the ERA in any venue, though she maintained an open invitation to discuss the ERA with any church authority instrumental in creating church policy. For her part, Campbell appeared on The Donahue Show with Relief Society President Barbara Smith, about a month or a month and a half, depending on when the date is, after Johnson. Especially in the months after Johnson's excommunication, pro-ERA Latter-day Saints reported threats and intimidations from local congregations and leaders. One woman reportedly refused to speak with a reporter because it might cost her husband his job at church-owned BYU. Others claimed that their bishops threatened to revoke their temple recommend. We can't know how many threats, if any, were acted upon, but they created a climate of significant fear for LDS believers who supported the ERA. Audrey McElrath, a coordinator of the California chapter of Mormons for ERA, told a reporter, quote, "When I see the bishop at my door, I get sick to my stomach. There's a gut feeling when I think about excommunication, but my conscience won't let me quit." So she and others persisted. At the same time, the LDS Church mobilized lobbying campaigns against the ERA in several unratified states. In these and other states, local congregations organized women into anti-ERA citizens groups, and local leaders asked members to donate money. Relief societies, often under the direction of local leaders, organized letter-writing campaigns and lobbied state congressmen. Johnson claims that in most instances, women were directed not to disclose their affiliation with the LDS Church and claim instead that they were simply private citizens concerned about the effects of the ERA on the family. In at least one instance, buses picked up LDS women at a local stake center in Missouri to take them to the state legislature to rally and lobby. It's unclear who chartered the buses and who paid for them, but I think the church is accurate in claiming that it wasn't anyone to do with the official institutionalized church. But Johnson sort of made a big deal out of it. Because to her, this really felt like dirty pool. She accused the church's central leadership of directing these activities and capitalizing on the religious conviction of her LDS sisters to compel them to campaign for their own oppression. Her opposition to these tactics primarily took the form of publicizing these activities and offering pro-ERA strategists activist strategies to expose, oppose, and defeat the political power of the LDS Church. One important tactic Johnson offered was to out-family the Mormons. Here, Johnson suggested that pro-ERA activists show their LDS opponents just how radical the ERA was not, and that it would not destroy women, women's ability and inclination to care for families. Rather, it would enhance those things. She pointed out that the LDS Church claimed they valued the family more than any other social institutions, but suggested to a crowd of ERA activists in Kalispell, Montana, that, quote, "So do you. The Mormons did not invent the family." Applause. applause. I've listened to this talk a couple of times. She likewise told another crowd in Fresno, California, the Mormons didn't invent the family. They don't own it. And we all have families, and we can use them, too, for the ERA. We believe the ERA is going to be terribly useful for the family. And so we need to put the family up there, too, and not let it be exploited by just one side when we all have one. Johnson advocated that activists bring their children to demonstrations outside LDS church and steakhouses and create buttons and signs saying things like, an attack on ERA is an attack on family, honor your mother, support the ERA, strengthen the family with ERA, things like that. Nobody, Johnson claimed, wanted to be against family and motherhood, so ERA activists needed to clarify to church members, church leaders, state legislatures, and the people of their communities that they too valued families and motherhood. As a fifth-generation, true-believing insider housewife who supported the ERA, Johnson refused to let male church authorities monopolize the political utility of the family and advised other ERA supporters to do the same. In another instance, Johnson advocated matching the church's letter-writing campaign with pro-ERA letters. She said, sign it mother of 10, 6, etc. Bishop Jeffrey Willis excommunicated Sonia Johnson on December 5, 1979. She was perhaps the first high-profile casualty in the church's confrontation with modern feminism, but certainly not the last. Since Johnson's excommunication, the church has disciplined at least 7 high-profile LDS feminists, excommunicating 6 and disfellowing the 7th. And we have no way of knowing how many low-profile feminists have been excommunicated, either through court proceedings or at their request. The church doesn't make public its membership or excommunication records. In 2014, the excommunication of LDS feminist Kate Kelly, the founder of Ordained Women, an organization dedicated to imploring male leaders to prayerfully consider female priesthood organization, once again made national news. It is telling that in the wake of Kelly's excommunication, Kelly interviewed Johnson, then 82 years old, for Salt Lake City's alternative radio station, KRCL. Likewise, writers in the Bloggernacle, which is a term often used to describe dozens, if not hundreds, of LDS-oriented blogs, who have reflected on Kelly's situation, almost invariably hearken back to Johnson's. So it's in the shadow of Sonia Johnson that contemporary LDS feminists negotiate their feminist and religious identities, communities, and activisms. Johnson's and others' experiences have tempered LDS feminists' willingness to engage church leaders, or for that matter, even come out of the Bloggernacle in which they have thrived. LDS feminists are frequently advised, often by other LDS feminists, that the way to make change in the church is through discreet diplomacy. Don't make waves. Keep quiet in public and work behind the scenes. And whatever else, do not embarrass the brethren. That is, don't be like Sonia Johnson. As Linda Silito, an LDS reporter who covered Johnson's ordeal, claimed in 1990, quote, Sonia Johnson didn't break the rules in the church handbook so much as the unspoken taboos. She wasn't nice. She did not conform. She didn't obey. She laundered the church's dirty linen in public. Close quote. The threat of church discipline, alongside a cultural commitment to conflict avoidance, limits the forms LDS feminism can and does take. Nonetheless, the conflicts Johnson's experience represented and the legacy of church discipline that continues to flow from these conflicts remind all of us that the philosophies, positions, and pain she articulated have not been resolved. So Mormon feminists persist. Thank you.
So I have a couple comments before I will open the floor to questions. I want to leave plenty of time for that. I'll start off by thanking our three presenters who have given us three different lenses on gender and sexuality in Mormonism. And unlike our presenters, I don't really have an excuse why I still say Mormon, so you're just going to, have to deal with it. There's so much left to be said about gender and sexuality in Mormonism, and I, for one, was very happy that MHA granted us this space this year. I'm going to do them in reverse order, because that's how I wrote it. Because why not? Christine Talbot took us through the Mormon involvement with the ERA, And I love the opening anecdote because I don't know about you, but that vibe was very familiar to me. It was a good reminder that mansplaining is of all times and all places. Sorry, I am very snarky. I don't know if you caught on that yet. So feminism and feminist advocacy in the church is a tricky subject because generally the narrative is one of mutual distrust and opposition, while the reality is much more complex, and we saw that in Christine's paper. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich once wrote an essay about Mormon women and second wave feminism. It's a lovely personal essay. And she argued that Mormon women, quote, weren't passive recipients of the new feminism, we helped create it, end quote. And that the larger American project of feminism and the smaller project of Mormon feminism developed along parallel lines, sometimes meeting, sometimes diverging. I thought it was really interesting that the ERA conflict between Sonia and the church was framed as a family feud. And I think that was a really good piece of analysis that the debates were on the legislation, but actually just so much broader about authority and control on the Mormon stage, and I'm not as well versed in what it on the national stage was, but that gender and family and sexuality are so often just lenses in which we can talk about bigger issues. Present in Christine's paper is the contradiction found in the church's essentialist position on gender and sexuality, and that's that traditional gender roles and heterosexuality are inherent and divinely ordained, but they have to be taught and internalized. Chris points out that while the church viewed the ERA as a danger to moral society and especially the family, like other conservative Christians, these issues took on a particular theological character in the LDS in LDS culture, which is a claim we also heard in the paper of Chris Babbitt's. Sonia Johnson, in her turn, also invoked Mormonism as she appealed to 19th century female political advocacy efforts to win suffrage that were fully supported by church leaders at the time. And I thought it was really thought-provoking that for both sides, their position on the ERA was very much informed by their religion. Johnson would butt up against Mormon patriarchy in her efforts, as Mormons like Orrin Hatch put women on a pedestal and insisted that they did not need or want any protections the ERA might offer them. It was a fascinating look at the different iterations of Mormon womanhood that existed and exist in the church, as well as a particular construction of authority in which men could speak for men and women apparently did not need to speak at all, or at least not in public. Johnson suggested pro-ERA activists try to out-family the Mormons, trying to show that the ERA would actually benefit them. The idea of out-familying opponents has proven fruitful in other contexts, too. In the years before marriage equality, which is, you know, not actually that very long ago, there was a joke that the gay agenda included cooking dinner and taking kids to school and, you know, all those little domestic activities. Highlighting the domestic is a very fruitful tactic, even though it also raises questions of respectability politics and the rights and humanity of people that are not interested in conforming to heteronormative expectations. For many, Sonia Johnson still embodies Mormon feminism, and especially the dangers involved in speaking out. Sonia Johnson, the September 6th, Kate Kelly, all have entered the Mormon imagination as either victims of patriarchy or agitators against the church, depending, you know, on your perspective. But in any case, feminist advocates are very, very well aware of what can happen when you don't play by the church's rules as a woman. And that brought me to Heather Stones' paper, who has teased out common threads in the stories of girls and their families for whom Utah, or Zion, looked to be a place of safety, but exacted a very high cost in return of conformity and isolation. The us versus them dynamic that was present in the world Christine Talbot described is here too, and Heather describes how young Mormon women learn to work within the constraints present in an isolationist culture that demonized non-Mormons as being of the world. And as one of those, you know, demonized non-Mormons, I, you know, felt really good about that. Many of those constraints were gendered in nature, again presenting a particular version of Mormon womanhood that these girls were to aspire to or face the unwritten but very, very real consequences. Where the story of Sonia Johnson was about publicly speaking out against church leaders, the stories of the women Heather talks about illustrate the internal pressures put upon women, generally by other women, in a display of the power of patriarchy. She works these themes out further in her dissertation, which I was privileged to read, and I was intrigued by her discussion of how framing young women as helpless victims in need of control introduced a pervasive distrust of the self. Girls and women being spoken for is a theme within Mormonism, it seems, as is women searching for modes of authority that will let them trust their experiences and themselves while fully engaging with the cultural context in which they live. And then Chris Babbitt spoke about gender too, but in the context of sexuality and particularly of conversion therapy. Mormon's theology hinges at least partly on mandatory heterosexuality, leading many to seek out or be sent to conversion therapy in order to be realigned with not just the proper sexuality, but the proper performance of gender too. And proper here is very much in scare quotes. I looked it up, and it was a relatively recent survey that estimated that 70% of gay Mormon men and 40%, I think, of lesbian Mormon women had done some kind of concerted effort to try to change their sexuality, which is, you know, a pretty high number there. Mormon theology makes the LGBT question not one of mere sin or transgressive desire, but one of salvation in a very specific sense. And unlike the agender, asexual angels of some other Christian groups, Mormonism holds gender to be eternal, with even less room for variance in gender identity, gender performance, or sexual identity. How Mormonism reflects the concept of gender deity in gender roles on earth is fascinating, as would be a more careful working out of what eternal masculinity and eternal femininity could mean than is usually present in LDS discourse. Christopher also discussed the ways these formal and informal relationships between church hierarchies and gender reparative therapists. That sentence is not okay. He mentions how these efforts brought Mormonism into the Family Values Coalition in a way that they had not previously been allowed in, and compares the situations within Catholic, Evangelical, and Mormon milieus. And none of these groups are known for their affirmative stances on queer sexualities or genders, but Mormon therapists tended to have a much closer relationship with the LDS hierarchy than Catholic or Evangelical therapists did. And some of it is clearly due to size or diffusion. You don't have a head of the Evangelical Church because you don't have an Evangelical Church. It's a way to denote churches that hold similar beliefs and cultural positions rather than a formal organization. But I imagine it does also have to do with the particular place that heterosexual marriage has in the LDS Church and how little theological space it has for singles, even straight ones. Celibacy does not actually solve the problem here. It doesn't have the same place in Mormonism as it does in Catholicism or Evangelicalism. I was actually interested in how these networks would compare across faith lines and not just denominational ones. How do Orthodox Jews or Muslims approach questions of gender and sexual identity? Ultra-Orthodox Jews often live in very tightly controlled communities or seek some kind of isolation from the world, and how would that influence their solution of the problem of LGBT people in their midst? And that's obviously far beyond your scope of your paper. And the paper that was made extra relevant by Utah's decision in March to not ban conversion therapy for minors. The church officially holds that people can change their sexual identity, but does oppose therapies that use abusive tactics. In 2010, still an estimated 54% of Utahns believed it was possible to overcome one's homosexuality. In 2012, church leadership published a position that sexual attraction was not a choice. Attraction was not, but behavior still is, apparently, and the church still labels it as immoral and a serious transgression. And I think that the recent reversal of the November policy denouncing coupled LGBT Mormons and barring their children from blessings and baptisms, for me that felt about as sudden as its enactment 4 years ago. And I think that indicates that the church itself is perhaps still trying to work out the practicalities of its positions, if not the positions themselves. The idea that younger Mormons are leaving the church in part because of its attitude towards gender and sexuality is almost an axiom at this point, and is often offered up by members hopeful that this will force the church to reconsider its positions, or at least allow for some nuance and complexity that at the moment is not present in LDS discourse around the same. These three papers have used the lens of gender and sexuality to discuss issues of isolation and integration, safety and belonging, identity and authority. And all of it makes me wonder, in 10 or 20 years here at MHA, what the panels about gender and sexuality will look like. And at the very least, I hope there will be more of them.